Everyone knows what it feels like when you come up with a really good idea. You know, it's not completely out of thin air. Usually it's formed in the back of your head among all the little unconnected thoughts and memories. And then there it is. Bam, the light bulb goes on. Well, what if we tracked the history of the most significant ideas humankind has ever come up with to try and see if there's a pattern with how we arrive at these little moments of genius? Well, that's what Steven Johnson has done. He wrote a new book called Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation, and he joined John Hockenderry and myself in the studio last week to talk about it. And when we spoke to him, John asked Steven if he found the task of uncovering the source of all that human inspiration a little daunting.
Well, the thing that was intimidating about this topic is that by writing a book about the whole history of good ideas, the potential number of topics and stories and anecdotes that you could tell was effectively infinite, basically. Any good idea that had ever happened in history was potential subject matter for the book. And so there was a year pretty much of just kind of wading through all that and trying to figure out what the kind of organizing principle was going to be. And once I figured that out, then it was a little bit easier.
I mean, people have lots of metaphors for good ideas. There's the light bulb metaphor. Yeah. There's Isaac Newton, you know, the apple fell from the tree, duh. There's gravity, you know, Archimedes in the bathtub, you know, with the eureka moment. We're really talking about a state of mind here.
Yeah, and I think actually that what was interesting to me in researching this is that I think those metaphors are misleading because they start with this basic assumption that an idea is one, a kind of a single thing that happens to you in a moment of kind of sudden clarity. And in fact, if you go back and look at the record, almost all, you know, important world-changing ideas, true innovative thinking, is one, it's much slower, and two, it almost always takes a form of a network. It's a bunch of different influences, different perspectives, different people collaborating on kind of filling in the pieces of a puzzle. And so the lone genius, you know, having the epiphany is really the exception, not the rule.
And the magic in the bottle is really not what we're doing here. It, you know, the story of Stéphane Tarnier,
right,
obstetrician, is a great case of when you have time to think about it, it comes to you.
Yeah.
Describe that story.
Yeah. Well, he was a doctor who was dealing with in Paris in the 19th century, and he's dealing with this terrible infant mortality rate that you had in big cities at that point. And he knew that if you kind of, there was a beginning of the understanding that you kept newborn children warm, particularly like early born low weight babies, you would find that the infant mortality rates would drop a lot. And so he takes a walk one day, and he's in the Paris Zoo, and he sees these little incubators for chickens. And he's kind of like, oh, wait a second, maybe there's something here. And so he comes back, and he kind of basically ports over from one domain this idea and brings it into a hospital. And it actually creates this revolution in the way that kind of neonatal health is kind of developed and has a huge impact in the 20th century on infant mortality rates.
It's fascinating because a lot of the stuff you write about, in hindsight, you don't go, brilliant. You go, duh.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because it really is about a change of worldview that suddenly makes something obvious that wasn't before.
Well, that's a lot of it is bringing an idea from one discipline over, either as a metaphor or as an actual technology. I mean, Gutenberg borrowed the screw press, which had been developed basically for pressing grapes and making wine. And that completed the project. He'd done all this work with type. He'd done all this work with ink. But he didn't have a mechanism actually for printing. And so he had to borrow something from a completely unrelated field, basically, and bring it over. And that was the piece that completed the puzzle.
Uncle Hans has the wine press. You should try it.
I mean, he was working on his problem. And he said, you know what? I got to go into the hills and just drink some wine for a while.
Really? I mean, here's what worries me, though. All this focus on entrepreneurship. You can go to business schools and get degrees in entrepreneurship. They think they've figured it out. That seems to me, A, adding a lot of stress to the process, which you say kills off the creativity. And secondly, the idea that you do have it figured out is really when you go wrong.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to argue in this book is that we've somewhat overestimated the role of the entrepreneur and the role of the market in driving innovation. Of course, it's been a big factor. But actually, if you go back and look at the ideas that then became kind of big world-changing commercial products and things like that, a lot of them actually came out of open information environments like the university system.
Uh-huh.
So the commercial product, yeah, the market is the thing that makes that. But actually, the university is where the kind of original idea comes from. And it's not always entrepreneurs. It's actually often academia that generates these ideas.
But that's one of the things that is inevitable when you're reading this book, is you're talking about places that are kind of disproportionately good
yeah.
at creating ideas. But then how do we create this? I mean, is there a model for recreating this in the schools to make the schools that ideal environment?
Yeah, it's really, I think we have an opportunity now for the first time in a long time to actually try and figure out how to do it. And one of the things is to figure out ways to break down the barriers between all the different disciplines, right? So that the kids aren't in this mode where they're like, I'm in math class now, and now I switch and I'm in English class, and now I'm in physics class.
Or I want to be a scientist, I want to be an English teacher, I want to be a, athlete.
Firefighter.
You want to do all of it.
Yeah, and you want to figure out ways to connect those different areas. And so if you start thinking about teaching, kind of a simulation or a particular topic or a historical moment where you're teaching the American Revolution, say, but you're also teaching economics because you're looking at the economy of the kind of colonial states, and you're also teaching physics because you're talking about gunpowder and how gunpowder changes, and you're teaching a little bit of math to do the economics. You're teaching all, and if you can figure out a way to kind of weave all these related but distinct disciplines together into one field, that's a much richer, more integrated way to teach.
Well, the great story in here is that there's a huge difference between where the washing machine came from, and that's looking at like extremely exhausted women doing clothes for centuries, okay? But where Tang came from, which was the orange instant drink on the Mercury craft that suddenly became like the entire sort of instant beverage industry, which is, billions and billions and billions of dollars. I mean, the thing going forward, what's next?
Well, I hope that what is next is we will see more public sector innovation, more examples of governments actually being innovative, which is very, we normally think of bureaucracies as being innovation sinkholes.
It's the opposite of the political discourse.
Right. But there's a growing sense of, this is a wonderful phrase by Tim O'Reilly, the idea of the government as platform, like a software platform, where local governments, federal governments, they have all this information that's crucially important to our lives, but they're very bad at kind of sharing and representing that and building interesting kind of interfaces for that. So what happens is the government takes all this stuff, releases it, makes it public, allows developers to kind of come up with cool, iPhone apps and Android apps that access that data. And suddenly you have this opportunity for basically, entrepreneurs, the public sector, and individual kind of hobbyists to build interesting new tools to make government more useful to our lives. And it's not just a question of the government getting more innovative. It's a question of the government tapping all these minds outside of government to help it be more creative.
It's worked in the auto industry. It's certainly worked in the software industry. Is there anything in any of these stories that you encountered in your research that you wished you'd invented?
Oh, my God. The whole book is filled with things that I wish I'd invented. But, there's a great story in the book about the invention of GPS. And you think of all the incredible...
You could have done that.
I couldn't have done it, but
if you'd been there.
I might have been able to maybe write notes while they were busy inventing it, but I don't think I would have been able to do it.
You could have invented Facebook and had a movie about
it. I'm not sure I want that right now.
Invented. Oh, my God. Stephen Johnson, author of Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.